It's Halsey with the Helicopter Podcast, and I hope you're enjoying listening to the podcast. But just to make sure that you are aware, if you would also like to watch the podcast, you can go to YouTube and check out the Helicopter Podcast YouTube channel. We post all of our podcasts to video format there. We're also doing a lot of really cool things over there, like vlogs. We did a bunch of fun stuff at HAI, including in-person interviews with all these amazing people. So do me a favor, head over to YouTube and check out the Helicopter Podcast. Hope you enjoy.
This podcast is brought to you by Celicopter. Tired of listings that go nowhere? Exhausted by tire kickers who waste your time? Don't sell your helicopter alone. Celicopter handles the entire process from start to finish. So if your helicopter is sat too long waiting for a buyer, contact the team at Celicopter today for your complimentary market valuation. Call 1-855-CELICOPTER, 1-855-735-5226, or email sales@celicopter.com. Celicopter. List it, sell it, done.
Hello and welcome to the Helicopter Podcast. This is Halsey Scheider and we are on episode 9, almost to double digits. Not quite, but super excited. Just a quick thank you to everyone that has reached out and been listening. I just feel beyond lucky and excited about the Helicopter Podcast and the value that we bring. And this show is totally that. I have pilot extraordinaire and also the creator, the starter of the blog, the rotorbreak.com. Love the name, by the way, Mr. Stephen Ryan. Stephen, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Hey, thanks, man. You know, I've never been called pilot extraordinaire before, so that's awesome.
I know. Sometimes I'm like just kind of a little too much on the fly when I'm doing the podcast. I'm like, what do I say? So hey, welcome to the show, Stephen. I'm so excited to chat with you. Your career started in 2001, or I should say your training started in 2001. You've done a handful of missions. You've flown some serious metal. And as of last year, you started this blog that is really cool. And I kind of just want to segue right into that because in some of the information that you sent me, your blog, I think it's titled, How Did I Get Here? Really kind of hit me because I think that if you are listening to this podcast, you would have to agree with me that being a pilot was just like not really a choice, right? As long as I remember being able to remember, I suppose, 3-4 years old, my eyes were always to the sky. So I highly recommend if you go to the rotorbreak.com, you got to check out this post if anything else, because it's really fun. And I think it's reminiscent of how most helicopter pilots feel. But why don't you just tell our listeners a little bit about what that blog post is all about and essentially how you got here, how you became a helicopter pilot?
Yeah, certainly. So the blog itself, though, we can talk about that later. The blog post on the blog just basically details how I got started and took me all the way up to my most recent job was with the Maryland State Police. So to summarize that, so I grew up in Ireland and I was
obsessed
with helicopters. What was that?
I said, I can't tell.
Oh, yeah. And you know, my accent used to be so much stronger, but I ended up doing tours in Vegas. This is back in 2006.
You did tours too.
I did Maverick.
Of course. Yeah, we have that connection. What year were you at Maverick?
2006 or so, five.
Okay, so a little bit. I don't want to say this to make you feel bad, but I might have not even been flying helicopters yet. But I was thinking about it.
I think it's about 10 years between you and I at Maverick. So that's...
But you still probably the usual suspects there, Dwayne Martin and probably some other guys are still pumping.
Joe's still the chief pilot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. Anyway, I interrupted you. So, grew up in Ireland.
Yeah, so grew up in Ireland and you know, not an awful lot of helicopters in Ireland. And so there's pretty much one show in town, and that was the Irish Air Corps. And the Irish Air Corps, they're the aviation branch of the Irish military. So they supported the Navy, the Army, the Law Enforcement Division, ran the gamut, right? Search and rescue, the whole thing. And they flew 6 Dauphines at the time. So if you saw a helicopter, you saw a Dauphine.
That's so cool.
So I became pretty obsessed with not just helicopters, but with the Dauphine. I mean, even now, if you look at it, it's sleek, it's good looking, and it's unique, right? The look of it, but also the sound of it is very
mm-hmm.
strong. So yeah, no doubt about it. I was obsessed. So I decided to go and fly helicopters. In fact, I applied for the Coast Guard. For the Air Corps. And believe it or not, it's probably true today, but even back then they took like 7 to 10 people applicants a year. So it was quite the competition.
Very competitive.
So needless to say, I didn't get that. I wasn't pilot extraordinary enough at that stage.
What can you do?
I know. So I had to go the civilian route. And there was no flight schools in Ireland, at least none that I could afford, right? So I had to decide where I was going to go. And the US was kind of expensive. So I decided I want to go to Australia. And funny story, actually, I went into the local bank. I'm 20 years old. I have a job. I'm doing sales or something, Went to the bank and I asked for a bank loan. And, back then you talked to the bank manager, not just...
Of course.
And she laughed. She actually laughed. Not many people laughed. She was like, what are you talking about? Helicopter flight school? What's all that about? So I came out and I decided I could either forget about it or I could find a different way. So I went to a different bank. In fact, there's only two in the town anyways. I went to a different bank. And I told them I needed a personal loan for vacation. Like, of course, we do personal loans, vacation, no problem. So I got a personal loan, started with that, and then went to Australia with the intention of getting my private license at least. And it went from there. I got a second loan and then a third, in fact, and I was able to pay for flight school for Australia.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that's definitely a unique way to get financing. I think, obviously times have changed. It's pretty hard to get anything financed these days, but it's kind of funny like that they wouldn't finance a legitimate career path. Like that's something of an investment, right? Because you would think the bank would be like, oh, you're gonna pay that back. Other like I'm going on vacation, that's just spending more money. But oh yeah, sure, we'll loan you on that. That's seems kind of silly. But you got through your training in Australia. And I gotta be honest, we had Nick on the show last week, I believe it was, and he trained in New Zealand, did some flying in Australia. But I don't think I've actually talked to too many people that actually did flight school in Australia. Is it pretty similar steps and process to what you know here in the States?
I was listening to that podcast with Nick Falloon, and one thing that struck me was when he mentioned about the way it was done. Like my flight instructor in Australia, it was like an end of career position, right? So this guy, in fact, no less than 3 to 4, maybe 5,000 hours every instructor, because
That's
the way it was done. You want a job in your local town, you want to be home every night, you get a flight instructor job.
And it pays.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas it's different here. And there's pros and cons. When I was over there, you turn up in the morning and you stay all day long. You turn up at flight school and you stay all day long. Then I came to the U.S. to do my conversion to the U.S. license. And it's more of a, you've got a flight at 2 p.m. So turn up at 1:30, I guess. It's more of a business.
Totally.
But, there's pros and cons to both, right? And so when I became a flight instructor here in the U.S., I could see... It flows better, perhaps, over here. But you're more of an environment, you're more embedded in the environment in Australia. At least I felt that way.
Well, some of my buddies and I were recently kind of joking about it because, first off, I think you and I have some weird mirror going on with our career, right? Because you're at Maverick. You're also at Hillsborough at a time, right? Did you instruct at Hillsborough?
Yeah.
That's crazy. So I'm from like Oswego actually originally. So that, like Hillsborough is in, you had to travel from Ireland. I got to travel 13 miles down 26, but the traffic on the 217 did suck. So, but I, talking about it with my friends recently and, at flight school, you look at the flight instructor at Hillsborough, you get the tan suit, you're like the cool guy on campus, all two girl students that were there out of the, 100 students would, oh, yeah, he's so cool.
Sure.
But, looking back at it, it's like, man, United States-based instructors, for the most part, don't actually know anything about the industry, or at least practical experience. And I think it's great. I mean, I felt like I was a great instructor and I was able to provide effective instruction, but that's kind of where it ended. Whereas if you get someone that has been flying EMS, flying offshore, done tours, utility, you could bring probably a lot of really cool scenario-based training and like anecdotal thoughts of, hey, I experienced this doing this, and really kind of have that translate through your teaching, which I think would be really beneficial. And I think that's probably somewhere that we miss a little bit. Not to mention, I mean, I don't know how it is now, but when I was flight instructing, I actually had to deliver pizzas on the side just to make ends meet. You know, so I would flight instruct all day and then I would be delivering pizza at night. So it's like this crazy, you know, lack of compensation where I'm assuming those guys are getting fairly well compensated, you know, in places like Australia and New Zealand where they do that a little bit different.
Yeah, I would think so. But it's not a perfect system either. And I won't speak for what it's like now, but at the time, even Australia, and you're right, the instructors had perhaps more to give experience-wise. It was also a scenario where you get your license, so you're a newly minted commercial pilot. Your first job, you probably won't see it for maybe 9 to 12 months. The first thing you'll do is you become a hangar rat. I used to call them hangar rats. Right? You come in and you talk about delivering pizzas on your time off. Well, you'd actually have a full-time job. And then come in the evenings and weekends and help out of the hangar and stuff like that, getting aircraft out, washing aircraft. And then finally, you might get to fly a helicopter or a ferry flight or something. So even though you've had this really stellar experience in flight training and you've had a very experienced instructor, what have you lost between that time and then 9 months later, 12 months later, when you actually get to fly again? So I don't know which is better. There's definitely pros and cons. Perhaps amalgamation of both would be best.
Sure. Yeah, it's kind of, you know, it's maybe a bit of a melding. And obviously, I probably don't see that ever really happening. I mean, I know that some schools have maybe a chief that comes in that, you know, my chief instructor at the time when I was in training, you know, came back from a career. So he, you know, he was able to talk about EMS and offshore. And that was really cool. But yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the training at Hillsborough and I felt like, yeah, especially, you know, 200 hours, certainly the blind leading the blind. But you're, you know, you're kind of been immersed in that training environment already for the last year and a half. So you kind of can just kind of keep that steam going. So obviously you're a young lad in Ireland and you're looking up, you're seeing the dolphin fly around and, you know, I mean, would you say you were a pretty young child knowing that, hey, this is what I want to do?
You know, I tell people I was obsessed with helicopters before I could ride a bike, you know. Of course, I learned to ride a bike until I was in my 20s.
That's funny, man.
No, but I was obsessed. And in fact, even when I finally went to flight school, I went to two flight schools. I went to Becker Helicopters on the East Coast. To Brisbane, but then I went to a different flight school down in Melbourne, and the specific reason I went down there, didn't do me much good, was the chief pilot of that flight school, it was called PHS, he was the one who introduced the Dauphine to Australia, right? And so, to the Australian the Victorian State Police, right? And I thought, well, maybe I could get that bit closer to the Dauphine by meeting this guy, you know? That's how obsessed I was with the Dauphine.
That's so cool.
It
didn't work there, but you truly were like maybe like borderline like ex-girlfriend stalking the dolphin, it seems like. Like maybe an unhealthy obsession.
No doubt. There was no other way. It wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when and how, you know. It was just gonna, and in fact, you know, I went from there and thought, okay, well, the Maryland State Police, and there's a few other operators in the US, but not many. In fact, there's still one or two now, but you know, the Dauphine's on the way out now. Yeah. And even back then, 2003. But I knew the MSP, I knew they had one, I knew they had 10, and that's on my radar, you know. And so I came to the US then to do my US conversion in Hillsborough Aviation, like you mentioned, and then went from there. I like the rest of it. So I zigzagged the industry then. I needed, you know, your next job, you need turbine time, and then you need offshore time if you want to get, you know, into a twin, and then you need NVG time if that's possible, or EMS time. It just never ends, right? In fact, I know it never ends.
It's kind of never ending. So you have taken that kind of that traditional path. I mean, untraditional, the fact that you grew up in Ireland, you trained in Australia, came over to the States, you did your conversion, which again, usually it's like you come to the States and then you go back home wherever and do conversions. Because I think I guess the finances are a little bit different than they were, because I think it's maybe a little more expensive, at least in Europe. I'm not sure actually about Australia.
Yeah, I did a lot of things backwards, to be honest with you.
That's fine, man. That's, hey, it makes it more exciting. And you're here, you've had You have quite the resume. So you did Maverick, you've done Air Medical offshore. How did you finally get to the Dolphin?
So, and just going back to doing things backwards, my intention was always to be here and be with the Maryland State Police. That was it. So for me, back home, like a lot of guys, they want to fly EMS back in their hometown, right? Back in France or Germany or Ireland or wherever they're from. But that wasn't it for me. There's no Dolphins over here. I went to Maverick. I went offshore for 6 months in the Gulf of Mexico. I didn't like that much. And then I applied for the Maryland State Police, and I feel like it was kind of maybe right time, right place, because it's a hard place to get into, and it takes about 9 months. In fact, it's sped up a little bit now in recent years, but you're looking at about 9 months of the application process.
And you might be able to actually give me some stats on this, but for our listeners that are maybe new to helicopters or just kind of unfamiliar with Maryland State Police, the Maryland State Police operate a very large fleet of aircraft that they use not only for law enforcement, but search and rescue and other operations. And unlike a lot of other law enforcement specific agencies, they actually hire civilians. Is everyone a civilian?
So anybody who's not is just kind of a leftover, perhaps from, you know, they've been around long enough. And in fact, I think there's only one pilot left out of about 70. That is a state trooper.
Wow.
Yeah, so what happened was in 1986, they had an accident. And at the time, the story, the way I understand it, is the insurance requirements went up and they required at least 2,000 hours. And it was difficult to get guys. They had some that perhaps were in the National Guard or previous military time who were state troopers and they could stay. But the rest of them, you know, anybody else coming in had to have at least 2,000 hours. And so that's hard to find.
Sure.
State trooper. So they started with civilians and then went down that route, and now it's probably easier because you can get guys in with a lot of experience rather than training somebody from, you know, from,
sure,
from the field. From the world, so.
Well, talk about backwards. I mean, again, I know nothing really about law enforcement. My good buddy Dusty Britton, if you're listening, what's up? He was like the chief of the air unit here in San Antonio, Texas. And, you know, essentially that was kind of like his path, right? He was a cop on the ground for a long time and he excelled in it. And, you know, he would go by the airport every once in a while and be like, oh, that's cool. They have helicopters, you know? And then one day it came up like, hey, you want to apply for the air unit, you know? And then essentially he gets thrown in these helicopters and, you know, trains and then has a 20-year career thereafter as a helicopter police, you know, pilot, which is, I mean, it works, right? Dusty's a great pilot, but it is kind of silly. I've always thought about that. Like, I've at one time was going to maybe become a cop, go work in Austin. You know, they have a AS-350. It's, you know, Austin pays good. It's like a great job, great town. And then they're like, oh, yeah, we'll hire you on. And, you know, maybe in the next 3 to 5 years, we could put you in the air unit. And I'm like, well, I'll forget how to fly a helicopter by then. Yeah. So it does seem kind of funny, at least on this aspect of safety and whatnot. Now, as a civilian, what is, because I know from experience, I've actually, I think, filled out the Maryland State Police application. And then I got like all these emails back and I'm like, oh, that seems like a lot. And I don't really want to move to Maryland. Wasn't my cup of tea, I suppose. But it's a pretty intense process, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. And just so you know, on that civilian versus law enforcement, so there is different types of, you know, aviation units, right? And so in your friend's case, he's probably airborne most of the time, if not all the time, right? He takes off, he does patrols.
Yeah.
So he's not landing in the wires on the football fields and the highways doing medevac. He's not over water in the Chesapeake doing rescue radar and stuff. And so his primary goal then is really law enforcement and law enforcement tactics, right? And so his experience on the ground does help. Whereas with the Maryland State Police, the majority of what we do is not law enforcement. It's medevac, it's search and rescue, and stuff like that. And so the tactics on the ground, while they're important, we can learn them for the 20% of those missions. And the rest of them, the IFR, all that stuff is what we need. Right? So,
sure.
So it's a different type of operation. And in the application process, so you're looking at, the reason it took 9 months was, you know, they do an extensive background check. They do a polygraph test, which they'll send you all the information for a polygraph test. You fill it all out. and then you go and do your polygraph test. You have to come to Maryland to do that. And then they do an interview, and now we they have their own simulator, right? So they, even though they don't fly the Dauphine anymore, they fly the AW139. They have their own $7 million simulator, and they'll put you in that, even if you've never flown one, just to kind of get an idea of what kind of
flight you like.
They'll start it for you. And you'll shoot an ILS or something like that.
Yeah.
And so the whole thing, you know, scheduling as well as the background check, as well as the polygraph test, you know, all that stuff takes time. Even scheduling the polygraph test, because there's only a certain amount in the state that can do it, right? A certain amount of examiners that can do it. And they're busy with criminals as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, that's crazy. I know that I think the polygraph probably actually scares a lot of people from applying. Is that, I mean, I'm sure you can't talk about the specifics, but I mean, do they ask that? It's my understanding, at least for like the Customs Border Patrol, might be a little bit different. They ask some pretty wild questions.
Yeah, so I can speak from the point of view of, you know, my own experience and some anecdotal evidence, and there's no doubt about it. It does keep a lot of people from applying, and then it does keep some people out that apply. But for the most part, what they're looking for is if you're going to lie on it.
Sure.
And so if you're nervous, you know, for the most part, it's not a problem, actually. You know, it's just about telling the truth, even if it's unusual, right? Now, if it's very unusual, let's
yeah, that's a different ball of wax. Well, that's cool. So so you go through the process. What year was this, by the way?
This is 2007 I started.
Okay, so you start flight training in 2001, and 6 years later, so you've zigzagged your way to MSP.
Yeah.
And you get to go to the Dauphine.
Yeah, pretty crazy, man, you know? Like, if it's an obsession for that many years, and then basically the spring of 2008 is when I got the job. And not only that, but it's, you know, a single pilot. So you really feel like, you know, you've made it. Like, dang. And the training, and in fact now it's still quite impressive, but it takes like 4 months, 3 to 4 months for the whole
wow.
training program, because you have a lot to learn, right? With search, even if you've done it before, you won't have done it with MSP. They always wanted to, you know, it's a state police agency.
It's their way.
But it takes time. So, yeah, you feel like you've gotten somewhere.
So what was that experience like for you to, you know, solo that aircraft for the first time? I mean, I almost feel like that would be kind of emotional.
Yeah. You know, I will admit, I remember my first shift. And I was torn between wanting the phone to ring, so I get a mission, and not wanting the phone to ring. Because you're like, oh, man, you know, because it's all on you, right?
Yeah.
And you've done your training and stuff, and now you're cut loose. And it's single pilot, single paramedic back then. Right now, it's a four-person crew.
Wow.
Back then, it was just a two-person crew. So
that's insane.
Yeah. On the way out to the mission, the state trooper paramedic is sitting up front with you, you know. And then you land at the scene, and they get out and do a thing, and then you're on your own up front, you know. And again, your first mission, you're looking around going, you know, all right, just like you do with any solo, you know, the first time you go solo in any aircraft.
Sure.
But now you're like, you know, you got to get this patient to the hospital or whatever the case may be, whatever you're doing right now. So, yeah.
Do you remember your first mission?
I don't remember my first mission, no.
Okay, so kind of funny story for me is kind of similar to you. I was doing air medical in deep South Texas, and I felt like the training I got was pretty good, but similar to you, I was like, oh man, like I'm pretty nervous, you know, like, and I'm nervous for other reasons too. Like I'm nervous to see blood and guts. I'm nervous to have feet next to me. I'm nervous about, you know, flying a helicopter that I haven't flown, or flying in an area that I'm unfamiliar with, or MVGs. A lot of things were kind of building up. And at that time, I was based in Del Rio, Texas. It's right on the border. And all the flights, for the most part, are always somewhere around Del Rio or at the hospital there in Del Rio to San Antonio. That's like your milk run. And so, of course, I'm with the training pilot, and I have it down. We actually did training flights out to San Antonio. I've seen every hospital. I'm feeling very confident. Of course, the tone goes off for my first actual scene, or my first flight. It's a scene flight somewhere in the middle of nowhere, Edwards County, for a car accident. And it turns out we get closer to another town, San Angelo. Completely unexpected. Never even heard of San Angelo. And so, of course, we have to go land up at a hospital up there. And what you kind of find is, like, you know, you're a trained helicopter pilot. You're a professional helicopter pilot. even though it's a little bit intense and, you know, you're a little more heightened, that you actually have the ability to go out there and be flexible.
And nobody else knows that you're nervous on the inside.
Right? Oh, I know.
Yeah. You've got the skills, you've got the know-how, and you can adapt. And it's just on the inside, you're like, ooh, this is a little bit unusual. On the outside, it's going to be fine. You'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. You kind of just, and you pull it together, and that's kind of a cool thing. And I was a little nervous because at that point I had done, you know, some flight instruction, some tours in a 44 and then Maverick, you know, and Maverick's kind of circles, right? Like just, it's just flying circles. It's a great job. I actually enjoyed it, but you know, it's, you don't go out there and test a lot of your piloting. So it was a bit of a different swap going in there. Did you guys have some pretty gnarly turbulence back in the day flying in the canyon?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Maverick, to be fair, they would go out sometimes, and I say they, but we would go out sometimes when you'd be like, well, it's within limits, so we can go, but...
Yeah.
But you know what? You live and learn, right? And so nobody pushed the envelope too much. You got passengers, you got a lot, you got a reputation of a company and yourself on board, so you know, there's a certain amount you can do, so yeah. And of course, turbulence is all relative. Like, they're relatively small aircraft. I've been in turbulence in much bigger aircraft, and realized, oh, that's what turbulence is.
Really? I mean, I just, because it kind of reminded me when you said, like, oh, people don't, you can't tell you're nervous. I felt that way sometimes going into the canyon. We were like, you know, getting just tossed around 50 knots wind, like, oh, you know, just like the helicopter rodeo. But so you get to the Dolphin, you're Maryland State Police, and it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, you were at the Maryland State Police, did your thing for a while, you left, then came back, actually. So how long were you there first time? And what is that? You can actually go to your blog, therotorbreak.com, and you can see the day in the life, because that's what the blog is all about. It's all about the day in the life of different skill sets. I wasn't invited as a sleazy helicopter broker to do the day in the life, so I don't know if I'll be able to do it or not. But there is one for the state police. However, for our listeners, please check it out. But if you could just tell us a little bit, just here on the podcast, what that day in the life is like for Maryland State Police.
Yeah, no doubt. It's so just to put in perspective, I got there, I flew the Dolphin for 3 years, loved it. But you know what? Take that box. I'm like, you know, what's next? And maybe it's typical helicopter pilot nomad type mentality, but I'm starting to go around. And so, you know, the short version is back in the 80s, 90s, you know, Ireland leased a Super Puma. And I didn't know it was leased at the time, but it had a Super Puma. And I was like, wow, you know, I mean, it's a beast, 21,500 pounds of aircraft. I thought, you know, they'd hit the big time. It was like the U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. military with all the versions of the Black Hawk, you know. And so that's always been my second goal, right? The Dolphin was the big one. The Super Puma was kind of like, well, maybe. And then I got the opportunity to go with CHC Global and essentially fly the Dolphin for them and the Super Puma. And so I was like, wow. Oh, I mean, I can't miss that up. So I decided I'd go for a year. And they had no requirement. You didn't have to sign on for a certain amount of time. But I went for a year and I stayed for five, because that's the kind of company they were. You know, they were that good, at least, I believe. So, you know, the pay was good, the conditions were good, the job was good, and I was flying a Super Puma, right? So things were good. But it's international, right? So you go to places like West Africa, you know, Kazakhstan, Turkey. Spent a year and a half in the Falkland Islands down there near Antarctica and stuff. So some cool places, some not so cool places. It wears on you eventually, and I decided to start looking around. And then, of course, by then, Maryland State Police had upgraded to the AW-139, four-person crew. They're now using night vision goggles. And so I called the chief pilot, Mike, and told him I was kind of interested. And by the time I was done with the four call, he already had my application back in. And
nice.
You know, it was quicker this time. I still had to jump through the hoops, but I knew the recruiter too, you know. So I called him and told him what the deal was. And it was, instead of 9 months, I guess it was 6 weeks. 2 months maybe.
Yeah, because you're kind of already in their system. Now, when, and we'll kind of get back to it, because I still am curious to hear about the kind of the mission profile of the Maryland State Police, but I do want to go to kind of what you're talking about. And something that we haven't mentioned a ton on the podcast is that there's a lot of personal struggles sometimes of being a helicopter pilot in regards to, you know, good pay, but maybe crazy locations and being away from home. When you were traveling that much, I mean, you don't have to, I guess, get super personal with it, but were you married? Do you have kids? I mean, how did that all look, and how do you juggle all that?
Yeah, so that is absolutely the driving factor, at least for me, why I did it in the first place, why I did the international stuff in the first place, and then why I stopped doing it. So I did it because we could live where we want, right? We were in Maryland at this stage we've been here for 3 years, but now we can live where we want because we're going to be going international anyways. The pay is going to be better. So I'm married and I have one kid at this stage. And we decided to move back to Ireland for a year and a half. And I commute from Ireland, so I'm going, you know, back and forth. And my wife and kid get a lot out of that. But then, you know, a couple of years later, now I've got two kids, and it's getting more and more difficult. And lots of guys do it forever, right? But now you make your own personal thing, like, okay, well, how much do you personally want to be away? And for how long? Because it's a 6-week tour, and 6 weeks is a long time. And then the travel, you're essentially looking at 7 weeks away and 5 weeks home. A 7-week away is a long time. So we decided to make a change. And in fact, CHC Global were going through some changes then anyways. Bankruptcy, essentially, and they kept some employees. And some were offered layoff, and so I took them.
Interesting.
So it was kind of handed to me.
It was kind of like, kind of helped kind of force the decision, if anything.
Exactly. Yeah.
And were you in the 332?
Yeah, the 332L2. Yeah.
And if for our listeners out there, the Super Puma, I mean, you talked about it a little bit, 21,500 pounds, big, big helicopter. In fact, I think I talked about it recently. I was up at Air Center Helicopters doing a pre-buy at a 407, and, you know, they had the 225. And I was just like amazed on the actual size of these aircraft. So, you know, if you could, I mean, this probably sounds like a stupid question, but, you know, I'm a guy that I've only flown single engine helicopters all under, well under 12,500 pounds. You know, I think, 5250 for the Bell 407. What is it like getting into an aircraft of that size? I mean, does it feel like a helicopter and it's just like, hey, it's status quo, it's pretty easy? Or is there more challenges to an aircraft that big?
So, a lot of people talk about like the autopilot, and they think, well, if you have an autopilot, which you would have an aircraft like that, then you're just a manager, right? You just sit there and you press some buttons and you just hang out. When that's not true at all. In fact, there's plenty of accidents that have happened because the autopilot wasn't managed. And there's a famous one in Sunborough in Scotland, where it was essentially, you know, it was fully coupled, but if you didn't do the right thing with the autopilot, which they didn't, the aircraft essentially crashed into the water. Right? And so, yeah, I was on approach to an island, and they were following an NDB approach. They had altitude engaged, but not airspeed. The aircraft is trying to hold altitude, but not the airspeed. And it begins to slow down, gets in the backside of the power curve. And so that's about aircraft management, right? If you sit back and you do nothing, then the aircraft can crash itself as quick as the
airplane. Sure.
So, having said that, you know, once you get in, and once you're aware of the size, you kind of... I want to say, you kind of forget how big it is in a way, right? Because now you're just sitting up front and you're just, it's like this. I was talking about turbulence, you know? We were doing a ferry flight through along the coast of West Africa. And man, we hit such bad turbulence. It kicked around the aircraft like you wouldn't believe. And, you know, it didn't care that we were 22,000 pounds or 21,000 pounds versus your 5,000 pound Bell 407, you know? And just like a 747 can be kicked around in turbulence. It's all relative.
Sure.
So the size, after a while, you know, you get used to it, and the systems are more complex because there's two of everything. Everything's redundant, and you have to manage the autopilot now. You have to learn a little bit about the flight management system and stuff like that. But other than that, man, once you get used to it, you know, you're still flying an aircraft, still flying a helicopter.
It's still a helicopter, but the stick on the left makes you go up, and it's, you know, you got pedals, and it's all good. Now, how do you start this Puma?
How do you start it?
Yeah, is it a Fadex start, obviously, or...
Yeah. So, it's funny you asked that. The, just talking about high winds, you know, I think you said something like 40 or 50 knots in the canyon.
Sure.
So, the Super Puma has a high wind start as well. And so you start one engine, and you have with the roll brake on, and then you release it once you get the engine up to speed. And then the quarterback releases and the blades start turning. But they start turning a lot faster, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. Kind of scary the first few times you do it. You know?
That would be really, that seemed really weird to me.
Yeah.
I think that would feel uncomfortable.
It is, and you got to do it often enough to get comfortable with it. It's used for high winds, so it's already, you already know it's a windy day, you know? And I forget, I think it was above 35 knots.
Yeah, just start it that way.
The high wind start, yeah.
That's really cool, and actually in your article that we were talking about earlier on how you got to where you're doing and things like that, you have some really cool photos as well of the Dolphin, of the Super Puma. Now, with the Super Puma on the 332, did that have any of the same issues as the 225 in regards to like the planetary gear that caused some of the mass separation? Obviously, it's all been, you know, remedied by Airbus. I think that they've done a great job at figuring out that the root problem was this like number 8 planetary gear, and a whole bunch of stuff went into it. But was that specific to the 225 or also the 332?
Well, even before you go that far as I know, it was specific to, firstly, to one specific aircraft, because that aircraft was involved, a gearbox, I should say, was involved in an auto collision, right? It was on the back of a truck. It was involved in a collision.
Yep.
They sent it back to the factory. They did a borescope on it. And some of the planetary gears were not viewable on that borescope. And that's what failed. And then that's that famous YouTube video with the rotor disc essentially departing from the
air. Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, it's not. And of course, when you have something as bad as that, then yeah, the unions, the offshore unions, they decide, hey, I'm not going to fly this the Super Puma of any kind ever again. And that's kind of what started. There was a snowball effect then.
It's making a resurgence, though. Let me tell you, it's like bell bottoms. Like, they're coming back. Actually, I don't know if bell bottoms are coming back, but we can pretend they are. I know that the Super Puma is a hot aircraft right now, and yeah, I think there was also with the planetary gear, they had two manufacturers of it. They realized that even though they were to the same tolerance, that it was, there was a fail ratio on one of the components, so they just went to one. And yes, they have like the new boxes that the gearbox is packed in with, like, I don't know how many sensors, but like for the box probably cost more than my house, you know, just to, you know, so to see if there's any shock to the gearbox during transport, you know, really crazy.
G-shock sensors, I guess. And in fact, you've probably seen the YouTube video that explains the whole thing. It's actually,
yeah, it's really good. Yeah, I mean, it's made by Airbus. So you're like, oh man, it's so good and I love it. And you're like, oh, that's that. But I trust it. I mean, I've talked to a lot of different operators. I know a lot of guys that have flown the aircraft, and you know, it sounds like all the proper remedies were made. So, maybe you're just not telling us, but it seems like, man, you want to fly the Dolphin, you get the Dolphin. You got this itch that you want to fly the Super Puma, you get the Super Puma. What did you have hurdles throughout your training? I mean, other than the zigzag, it kind of seems like, you know, you did get some of the things that you wanted. What were some of the stuff that is maybe not so glamorous as getting into the Dolphin, flying the Super Puma?
Did I tell you about the bank manager that laughed?
I did tell you about the bank manager. Yeah, you did tell me about that.
So you know, of course I have. I dare say I don't regret anything, right? But looking back, you always think, hey, I could have gotten there faster. Like, I went to the Gulf of Mexico for 6 months.
Okay.
The Gulf of Mexico, and I spent 6 months there as the spare pilot in a Bell 206. And I had like 3,500 hours. And new people were coming in, and they were going straight on the S-76. And it was just bad timing for me. It wasn't, they just got lucky, and I didn't get lucky. But that's why I left. You know, I'm not one of those guys who will turn up and then quit just because it's not going my way. Excuse me. But at the same time, you kind of have to choose your destiny in a way, have a focus, and be a little bloody-minded about it. Otherwise, you turn around one of these days, and you go, oh, I wish I had it done. I mean, you've done this. You've been at the bottom of the Grand Canyon with a couple of guys who come over to you and go, oh, I'm an accountant, but I sure wish I had followed my dream to become a helicopter pilot. And you're like, this ain't the fourth time I've heard that today, right?
Yeah, so you have the coolest job in the world.
Yeah, you have the coolest job in the world. And for you, of course, it may be a stepping stone, right? Like, yeah, it's cool, but I'm heading, you know, to the next big aircraft. I had some of those. I guess I'm a little, obsessive, perhaps, a little bit on at least the things I want to do. The next one was the Black Hawk. I really wanted to fly the Black Hawk.
Who doesn't?
Yeah, who doesn't? So, you know, I just quit my job a few months ago with the state police to fly the Black Hawk with Coulson.
That's amazing.
And, you know, quitting your job in the middle of a pandemic, not exactly recommended. But again, this is my goal. This is what I want to do. I'm one of the flyers. And so I'm like, all right, this is going to happen.
Yeah, and sometimes, honestly, like, I hate to say it, but it takes a little balls sometimes to, like, go and get what you want. You know, if you want to be comfortable all the time, you just got to then just keep doing what you're doing, status quo, and be miserable. Or, you know, if you have a little kahunas and you're willing to assess the risk and make sure that it's not going to completely bury you, then you can go out and kind of put yourself out there. I mean, with my business, I was like, granted, the pandemic started right after I quit all my jobs. So the pandemic didn't happen yet. And I had built the brokerage for 3 years, but it's just kind of a side hustle. Rebranded. I was like, I'm going to rebrand this helicopter. And then I'm going to quit all my jobs because I can. And then the pandemic happened like 2 weeks later. I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, and, you know, by the grace of God or whoever, it's worked. Right. And, you know, I think it's somewhat of a necessity. You just press forward and you make it happen. But the timing's never perfect. And I think that sometimes, specifically in this industry, people are always looking at the timing, like, oh, I got to have the time to do this, or I'm going to have kids, so I have to do this now. You know, so I admire that. I respect the fact that you've been very goal-oriented in getting what you want and taking some risks to get there. I mean, I would say giving up a job at the Maryland State Police, very steady, probably a good paycheck, good benefits, government. You know, to go fly Blackhawk, you know, that was probably not an easy decision, but something that you wanted to do and you lived once. So kudos to you on that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah. I you just got to take the risk sometimes. And there's negative side effects too. I mean, I've zigzagged the world and certainly the country with different jobs. And luckily I have a supportive wife and family, and it's not just a matter of, should we do this? For a lot of people, it's, can we do this? Because, I mean, you have a support system, perhaps, in your hometown or your home state or whatever, and,
sure,
and you don't want to leave. So for some, it's easier than others, and I guess for me, it's not quite as difficult because most of my family is 10,000 miles away anyways, no matter where I go.
Yeah, no matter where they're at, they're just still in Ireland. Yeah. Well, that's cool. So you're in the Black Hawk now. And you brought up some really cool safety topics that I want to touch on, but I am also curious to kind of transition a little bit away from your flying background. And last year, I believe it was, is you started a blog, therotabreak.com. And how did that all kind of come about? And, you know, where does that all spawn from? Have you always been someone that wants to be a writer as well?
No. So I had one specific goal. Right? Here's the problem. I wanted to fly firefighting aircraft, right, for a long time. And I even remember when I came to the Maryland State Police at the time, it was kind of, I want to fly the Dauphine, but I want to do firefighting. They're not going to mix right now, so I follow the Dauphine. But even such back as far as 2008, I wanted to fly firefighting. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to find, like, specific information, not the kind of stuff you get from HR departments, nothing against HR departments, right? But, like, what really is it like on a day-to-day basis? In fact, when I look into firefighting, most of the jobs back then were maybe, you know, kind of like camps, like logging, that kind of stuff. And I kind of pictured that. It's not like that now, it seems. But I certainly thought it was. But I wanted to know what the deal was. And so my idea was, if I could start a website where people could send in their day-in-the-life stories, and then I'd learn about specifically firefighting.
That's
so
awesome.
Proof of concept, right? I have to do one myself. And that's why I wrote three articles on there. And I'm not, you know, I'm as far from a professional journalist as you'll get. But I'll leave that stuff to Heliops and Vertical Magazine. That's their job.
Sure.
This is written by pilots for pilots, right? So I use Grammarly and stuff, and I'll check my spelling. So it's not
Same.
Too difficult.
Grammarly is the best. I'm not sponsored by them. I have no financial stake. In fact, I pay them monthly. Highly recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah, why not, right? And so it doesn't up my level of journalism, but it certainly makes it a whole lot easier to read.
And so, seriously.
So I did that, and surprisingly, there's a lot of pilots out there, and in fact, flight paramedics and crew chiefs and rescue techs that are interested in writing something as well, right? You go on Instagram, there's plenty of people who really want to be, you know, influencers or whatever in their side hustle in a way. So I got lucky. I got a couple of guys. I asked, hey, would you be interested in writing A Day in the Life? Personally, I'm kind of a linear thinker. I was thinking the right, you know, I turn up at 7 a.m., I leave at 7 p.m., this is all the things that happen in the middle. But I got guys that have got a flair for writing. I got some amazing stories, right? And these are people who haven't written anything before, probably ever, you know, from a journalistic point of view.
Sure.
And they gave it a shot, and it came out awesome. So cool. Then Heliops Magazine, they republished one. They liked it. Vertical Magazine has republished a couple of them. They liked them. They pick and choose the own one that they want to republish. But
of course,
well, you find people in any industry who has a flair for something, and you know, the big publishers will find them and go, hey, you know, now that you're a diamond in the rough, we're going to republish you. So,
man, it's so cool. And yeah, like you know, you've been published by, you know, or some articles have been published. And I mean, I don't know, it's kind of similar to the podcast in the sense, like, I don't really have an expectation for the podcast, and maybe that's why it's been able to have a little bit of success early here. It's because it's just kind of natural, and it, with really no set expectation. I mean, you and I fumbled for 20 minutes just to get on here today. I mean, this is not a professional. This is not a professional deal. We try to make it entertaining and have good value, but it's really cool. And so now, can anyone just go on the site and write one of their own blog posts?
Yeah. So can't use your words. There's no agenda, right? Except it is, I did get some articles that were kind of well written, but weren't on the Day in the Life theme. Excuse me. And it's easier if I just keep it that way for now.
Sure.
So, yeah. So what I'm looking for, what it was designed for is, you know, you're an offshore pilot and wondering what firefighting is like, or you're an EMS pilot in Ohio and you're interested in Maryland State Police. It won't give you, you know, zero to hero, might not even give you the requirements because everybody's writing a different story. You ask three pilots in the same office to write A Day in the Life, there will be three different versions. However, it gives you a feel for the job, and that's what it's all about. So, yes, if anybody's interested, you know, and again, not, if you see something that has already been published, it doesn't matter. We can republish a similar title. And again, people would love to hear the same, you know,
different perspectives.
Sector. Yeah, a different perspective in the same sector. So.
That's really cool. And how many blog posts are you guys at now?
So I think there's about, I think it's about 18 or so.
Man, that's so cool. And so if people want to find your website, it's therotabreak.com. You also, you're on Facebook, LinkedIn. That's kind of the best ways to connect with you.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, no intention of being an influencer by any means, but yeah, Instagram as well. You know, it's a visual thing. I show the pictures. So if you want to write a story, it's the Rota Break, BREAK, as in coffee break. And then
the logo shows that as well. Very good.
Yeah. And then, you know, you send them some pictures because, you know, us helicopter professionals, we like to see the story as well as read the story, right?
Of course.
And then we put those up on social media. So.
Yeah, it's really, it truly is. It's almost kind of like when you're asking someone to write a story about what they do, it almost is like you're having a coffee with someone, you know, and you're just talking about it. Like you and I are talking right now about, you know, the experience. So it's really cool. I love the idea of a blog. In fact, I started a blog for selling, you know, with the intention of adding value to people that want to sell. It's hard, man. Writing is so hard, and it's hard to be motivated to want to wake up in the morning and be like, type away. So, you know, it's tough.
And at least with the Rota Break, for me, I'm leaving it to people who are really, I'm more of a facilitator, right?
Sure.
And now I have a list of questions that I can send to people that they can, okay, if you want to write it, if you answer these questions, you'll have a blog post, right? And so it'll make it easier for people. But hey, if I can do it, and if I can do it three times, man, we can do it.
And yours is great. I read it yesterday. It kind of gave me some goosebumps just on this idea of being a kid looking up, seeing the dolphin, and then ultimately getting to the dolphin, getting to the Super Puma. And, you know, that passion. I told you on the phone, but you know, we used to go to a place in Oregon called Sun River, where we would, you know, the intention for most kids on spring break or summer break, you go to Sun River, you ride bikes, you swim, do whatever kids do when you're, you know, 10 to 14 years old. And we would show up and I would ride my bike to the airport in the morning and just sit at the airport all day. And I would watch airplanes take off. The occasional helicopter would fly in. I remember a 500 came in one day. I was at the pool, like got on my bike, couldn't get there fast enough to see this thing. And you know, I'd always try to score, you know, try to score rides. And it's just funny. I your article kind of spoke to me a little bit of this, like, man, that's, you know, just being this kid looking up at the sky always. And it was never like, everyone just knew, like ever since I was like four or five, like, oh yeah, Halsey's a pilot. Like Halsey wants to be a pilot, you know, which is kind of wild. And I'm pretty glad and stoked that I still get to fly, not at the same capacities as maybe a full-time pilot, but it's really still a passion. Now your career, you know, 2001, you've been doing this for a fair amount of time. And, you know, undoubtedly throughout your career, you've probably learned some lessons in regards to things that maybe scared you a little bit, or something that you wish you could have maybe done a little bit differently, or you're glad that it happened, so you learn from it in regards to safety. What are some lesson learns for you? And if you could speak to some younger pilots out there, not necessarily guys that are like brand new, but guys and gals that are maybe the 500-hour pilot, the fresh out of flight school flight instructor, the guys flying tours, the guys offshore. What is some wisdom? I mean, you have 20-plus years. I'd love to get some of what you've learned over that time.
Good question. I think there's perhaps two things that and they're probably not, you know, that surprising to you, but you know, when you're a flight instructor, so your first job as a flight instructor, you always brief the student, right? Told them, this is what we're going to do today. And then when you're done, you said, this is what we did today, and this is what we intended to do, and here's how it worked out, right?
Sure.
Day one, you started with a brief and a debrief. And, you know, it should be the same for every job. If you fly with more than one person, there should be a brief and a debrief. And I've come back from enough missions where, you know, it was blue sky, it was milk run, like you mentioned. It was an easy flight. It was to and from the large metropolitan trauma center. Maybe we didn't even land on the highway. Maybe we landed in a soccer field. It was relatively simple, right? And yet, I'd always ask, you know, let's have a quick debrief. And surprisingly, something might come up, right? The newest member of the team might have a question or point out something that will take you by surprise. So that wouldn't have happened if I hadn't said, hey, let's debrief. So I've intentionally made sure that every flight, every mission, we debrief. And it can be quick. It can be, you know, 30 seconds. If you're with four people that have, you know, very experienced and the crew don't have anything, that's fine. We give everybody the opportunity. So always a debrief if there's more than one
sure.
person. The second thing is, you know, I personally, I love CRM. I love reading NTSB reports. And AeroAssurance in recent years have made it really, really easy. If you don't follow them on LinkedIn, you should. They do summaries of NTSB reports. And so it's a whole lot easier to read, I guess, or at least it's smaller.
Sure.
And so I read them religiously. And once in a while, I'll read something and I'll be out flying. And I'll be like, man, I've been here before. This is something similar. And I could get caught like that guy did, you know in whatever story I read. And a quick example, you know, we do with the state police, plenty of low-level searches, you know, maybe searching for a suspect or a missing person. And that same low-level search could easily turn into a medevac, right? So it'd be like, hey, found somebody, they're injured, now it's a medevac, and so you can land, you know, right there.
Sure.
Similar scenario in Japan, where they were doing a rescue, and they were doing the same thing, and then they had the gear up because they were just doing a hoist. And then it turned into, hey, that patient is not that bad. Can you land right here on the beach? And they landed there with the gear up, of course. And stuff like that, little things maybe, but you read those and you go, okay, well, I should make it a policy. If I'm doing low-level search, there's no reason for the gear to be up. You know, it should be down just in case, right? Stuff like that. And there is, of course, alarms that tell you that the gear is up, but obviously they missed it. So,
yeah, I mean, it can certainly happen.
Yeah. So I read those reports a lot.
Well, I think it's great, and I think it's I think as helicopter pilots, what we'll often find, and I think this was one of the primary focuses of SMS, and I'm no expert on SMS. However, Tease, we are having an expert on both CRM and SMS next week. Daniel Duderman, owner of the Squadron, a guy that has a ton of experience, and I think we're actually going to mold it into a series with him as well, kind of a monthly one episode deal, talking about that. So I'm no expert, but I feel like the point of SMS is to learn from, was this an isolated event or is it a systemic problem? And at a micro level from a company, you can go ahead and, figure out that, hey, Maryland State Police specifically, this incident happened and, hey, it was systemic. Let's make a policy. But with NTSB reports, you get to look at the industry as a complete whole. You're not just isolated to your specific operation, your company. You can read, incident reports from all over the world where you could be like, oh, man, I don't think that's necessarily a one-off. That seems very systemic. And sometimes rules change, right? Rules get, the FAA looks at something and says, hey, this is what caused it. We need to make an amendment on a rule or whatnot. So I think it's foolish not to learn from people's mistakes. And I think that I personally have not done a good job at continually following up with NTS reports. I like the idea of kind of a Cliff Notes version. So again, where can I go and where can our listeners go on LinkedIn to find those for the Cliff Notes?
Yeah, so Aero Assurance, and again, I don't know anything about an insurance company, I believe, but
they sure
have a section. But if it's easier to follow them on LinkedIn, because then you just get their stuff.
Yeah, it just pops up.
Yeah, so Aero Assurance.
And as far as the briefing, I think what I learned flying air medical is like, part of it was to do a brief. And I always felt that it was not fair, specifically to the crew, if I didn't give them the opportunity to say something. There's a big mindset change from, maybe 10 years ago to today, where it's like back in the day, your crews, you're self-loading baggage. They have nothing to do with the operation, yada, yada, yada. And the company that I worked for was really focused on, crew resource management. They're part of the team. One of them wears goggles in the back. And I actually did. I mean, I had a paramedic save my bacon one night, pointing out a tower that I did not see during a recon, an unlit tower in an area that he was more familiar with than I was. So he saw it. So I really think that they bring a lot of value. And during a debrief really allows you to dissect certain scenarios that maybe you couldn't really give enough thought to while you were flying, and it's a good time for the team to come together and just make sure. And like you said, sometimes it's, hey, good flight. Y'all got anything? No, don't got anything. Other times it can go down the rabbit hole. And I always had good med crews that always want to kind of learn and get better. So I really like the idea of debriefing, and you can do it with any mission profile.
Yeah. And if you think about it, on a 4-person crew, everybody is 25%. If one person is not given a voice, maybe you're down to 75%. That would be, when you think about it, that's crazy. So everybody should have a voice and give the opportunity and be told as well, hey, you might be new, but we can't afford to lose you. You're 25% of the crew. You better speak up. If you see something, say something.
So. Yeah. And at the air medical company that I had, we also had like the 51% rule, which gave, the voice to the nurse or the paramedic where, any time they could veto a flight, all they had to do is say it. Now, you maybe not being a great pilot if you let it get to that point, because the whole purpose is like you all talk and brief prior, like, hey, and if they voice concerns, you can either, address their concerns and collectively come up with an outcome of go or no go. But if you still choose to go and they're not happy with it, they are given that 51% power.
But you're absolutely right. That normally wouldn't come to that because you're kind of just making the decision as a group as you go along. And then if it's a no go, it's because you all decided it for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, I had never been in a situation where I had a crew member, come close to 51%. We just all talked about it. We're like, yeah, okay, you're not comfortable. And you know what? Fair enough. It's right on the line, and we don't need to do it. So we don't do it. And that's another hard thing. I mean, you with search and rescue being a primary mission for Maryland, there could be someone else's life on the other end of that tone, right? And if you don't go, that person could die. I mean, that's the kind of the conundrum of air medical. There was a lot of nights where a lot of people potentially died because I couldn't go, right? The ceiling was too low. The visibility was that good enough. And that's just something that you have to accept. And you cannot allow that mission pressure to get to you. I'm guessing the Maryland State Police, they give you probably pretty firm minimums.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's you know, for the most part, we're non-mountainous on the, you know, the eastern shore and stuff, and then there's some mountainous areas to the west. So that they're different depending on which base you're at, but yes, we have a set of stone, essentially.
Yeah.
So, but you know, even still, like, you know, you read the weather and you're like, well, it's above minimums, but it's trending below it, and the forecast, there's a lot to take on board, and you might still not go. And then you're right, somebody has to be driven to the hospital, and it could be 3 hours drive instead of a 15-minute flight or 20-minute flight. So, but that's the nature of it.
Yeah, it really is. There's nothing that you can really do about it. But I can't believe this, Steve. We are coming up on our time for today. Man, that was so much fun. You've had a super long career. You also know, I forgot to ask, because we have a mutual contact with Sean Moretz. How do you know Sean again?
Yeah, so Sean was in Vegas. He was flying the Hughes 500 while I was flying the Bell 206.
Very cool. Yeah, good old Sean Moretz. He just had a second kid, and he's still flying, man. That guy's like the ultimate pilot, I feel like. And episode one. So if you all haven't listened to episode one, check that out. But Stephen, thank you so much. It's therotabreak.com is for the blog. You're now moving on to Colson. So I have to have you on maybe after your first, because you're coming up on your first season, right? You just started.
Yeah, I just started with them. Yeah, so, you know, I think you had Trent on a couple of days ago. He said he had 11 hours in the S61, you know.
Yeah.
He's got me beat. I've got 30 minutes in the Blackhawk and 30 minutes in the Chinook. So,
Hey, you got to start somewhere. Yeah. We also had Yo-Yo Rose on, who we actually did a two-part series with him, a ton of Blackhawk experience, utility, and firefighting. So that might be a good podcast for you to check out if you haven't listened to that one yet. But hey, good luck, man. Don't be a stranger. Love to hear about your, you know, I think it's a cool perspective, actually, being new in a new environment as an experienced pilot, right? Like this weird concept of, like, you know, you've been doing this for 20 plus years, and now you're going to go put yourself in an unfamiliar aircraft in an unfamiliar environment. So I know that you're going to be safe, but please be safe. Please, if you're willing, share those experiences either on your blog or back here with the Helicopter Podcast. We'd love to hear about it. But thanks again for joining. Episode number 9. Everyone that's listened, thank you so much. We appreciate the feedback. If you do like this podcast, you can like it. You can share it. We're on all major platforms, Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. If you have ideas for future shows, please reach out. If you want to tell me I suck, you can do that too. Doesn't matter. I love it all. So this has been episode number 9 of the Helicopter Podcast with Stephen Ryan. Stephen, thanks again so much.
All right. Thank you, Austin.
As always, a special thanks to Celicopter for producing this podcast. Specializing in helicopter evaluations, faster sales, and superb service, Celicopter is the go-to agency for clients expecting immediate results. Celicopter's team of helicopter professionals are the best in the business. Using their aviation expertise, a nationwide network, and a proprietary 76-step listing strategy, Celicopter will convert your listing from Mayday to Payday. Ready to get started? Text Helicopter to 1-855-CELICOPTER. That's Helicopter to 1-855-735-5226. And a Celicopter pilot agent will reach out. Celicopter. List it, sell it, done.